Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and like welcome to the program today, Claire Vey Watkins, her collection of short stories, Battleborn, just came out. She joins us by telephone from Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Claire.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Claire, is this the first book for you?
It is, indeed, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's been a journey, I understand.
Well, isn't everything, right? Yeah, no, it is. I wrote the book while I was a graduate student at Ohio State in the MFA program there.
And that was a long trip out east for you, I hear. You'd never been east before you came out to Columbus.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in rural southern Nevada, and then I went to college in Reno at the University of Nevada, Reno.
Uh-huh.
And when I went to Ohio State, it was kind of a reverse manifest destiny for me going back east. And it was a real, I always feel a little bit silly saying that it was a culture shock to get, you know, but it was for me. And that's kind of the place that I started writing the book from, was a place of kind of homesickness, honestly.
Did it help to have that distance to focus on where you were writing about? Because so many of these stories take place out west.
Yeah, in fact, all 10 of the stories are set in Nevada, at least in part. And it definitely helped. It hadn't really occurred to me to write about Nevada until I left. And then I was really homesick for the place, and also my mother had just died, and so I was really, you know, grieving for a lot of different things in many different ways. And so I started just kind of writing about the places I missed the most, you know, like the Black Rock Desert or Nye County and Lake Tahoe, places like that. And I definitely don't think I would have ever, I mean, who knows if I would have found that material without coming to Ohio, although I have to admit I sort of kicked and screamed all the way.
Well, your fondness for Reno definitely comes through in these stories, but I'm not so sure about Las Vegas.
That's very, very, very keen of you, Vic.
Let's talk about some of these stories. The first one, Ghosts, Cowboys. I can see why you started with this one, but wow. I mean, that just, as a reader, you're just drawn right in. You're like, oh my. How much of this, when you read it, you're like, is this fiction? What is this?
Yes, well, I think that's just the kind of questions the story wants you to be asking, you know? And a lot of, I think probably every really good story that I love leaves you with some version of that feeling. Did this really happen? What's true here, right?
Mm-hmm.
It feels so real. And I think that's such a major, probably the best compliment I can get, is it feels so real. And, you know, I never want to give up the game, but I definitely am. It's a story that's not being subtle about playing with the line between truth and fact, or, you know, art and truth. And
Well, we're on the FM band. I leave sensationalism to my colleagues on the AM band. and I can see how it would be kind of difficult to talk about some of this, because we do have this blurring of the lines, what is real. And I'm guessing that there's some trepidation on your part from hoping that people will be respectful and not go towards sensationalism, if you know what I mean.
I do. Yeah, I think I do know what you mean. There are a lot of, you know, a lot of things going on surrounding the book. I mean, the main thing is just real, like, elation, and I'm just really grateful to have it out there. But I do feel a little bit vulnerable now, mm-hmm. having it out in the world. Probably everyone who publishes something feels that on some level, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But because, in fact, even though Ghost Cowboys is probably the most, like, overtly playing with autobiography, I call it, like, a story that uses the form of autobiography. But all of the stories are really, really close to me, and they feel, it feels pretty raw still to talk about them.
Yeah.
But I think that that's, I have to kind of remind myself that that is a good thing, right? If they're, if it's good, it should be a little bit scary. You know, if those stories are working, they're working because they still feel a little bit raw or a little bit too, one of my teachers at Ohio State would say, you know, you must write close to the bone.
Hmm.
So I think that I would rather be writing close to the bone and feel a little bit exposed and vulnerable than be too safe, become sort of robotic about it. Although, yeah, you know, talking about your father being in the Manson family or something on NPR is a little, it's a certainly surreal and kind of scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, as an interviewer and a reader, I'm always tiptoeing around the process because so many writers, particularly ones that I admire, don't want to talk about it.
Oh. Huh.
They don't. Yeah. It's like it's a sacred thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, they don't want to be Jackson Pollock. You know, they don't want to give away their secrets.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I sort of came of age in a community of writers, first at the University of Nevada, and I studied with a writer named Christopher Koch there, and we had this sort of cohort of very, I mean, we were all very young, but we all wanted to be novelists, you know, and we would talk about it a lot. And then, of course, when I went to Ohio State, I found this really tremendous community, not only of the people, the other writers there who became, you know, the best friends, my very best friends, but also teachers and visiting writers. And I think there is a little bit of magic and mystery to writing,
mm-hmm.
but there's also, you know, some, not all, a big swaths of it are just kind of nuts and bolts stuff that it feels really good to have other people to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, about, so, you know, I'm kind of stuck on this. Can I bounce some ideas off you? And of course, MFA programs get a lot of, have for some reason experienced a lot of backlash on this topic, right? But when you think about it, it's really difficult to think of any artist who doesn't have some community, even if it's just one other person, saying, you know, what do you think about this? What should I do here? So I try not to be too precious about it, honestly.
Good. I'm talking to Claire Vey Watkins. Her new collection of stories, Battleborn, just came out. Donald Ray Pollock, is he one of the people that you met up in Columbus that you connected with?
Yeah, absolutely. He was in the first workshop that I took there. He was just on his way out, and I was on my way in. And, of course, he was, you know, stunning us every time he would turn in a story. It was just really great. And he's definitely, I mean, there are a ton of writers there that I thought, wow, I've really got to, if this is what's coming down the pipeline, I really got to get better here. And he was probably at the head of that pack.
Well, in his collection, Knock'em Stiff, you can just feel him sweating blood over every single word.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful way to put it. And it also does feel urgent, right? You
mm-hmm.
do get the sense that he had to write it. And he's someone who also, like when we talk about his fiction, we kind of can't help but talk about his background, right?
Right.
You know, for better or worse. But I think that really deep down, that is such a good sign because it makes us want, it feels so real and it makes us want to know, you know, did this really happen? Which is kind of the real magic of fiction, that even though we're told again and again, this is made up, these are lies, they do something else, something bigger, right? I mean, the first line of Slaughterhouse-Five is, all this really happened, you know? In Tim O'Brien's The Things I Carried, again and again, he sort of says, this is really what happened. But then you say, well, is it? And
uh-huh.
it's kind of, I've always thought that the playfulness of that was really delightful.
I have some particular favorites in your collection, and one of them is The Past Perfect, The Past Continuous, The Simple Past. This is a really interesting story. It's mostly set in one of these brothels in Nevada.
Yes.
And you have this Italian who is looking for his friend. And this is just a really almost surreal. It's the atmospheric feeling you get from the story is just really enchanting.
Thank you. Yeah, that story is a version of a story that I'd been told a lot growing up, because the town where I lived is sort of sandwiched in between Las Vegas on one side and Death Valley on the other side, and my mom ran a museum, a little rock shop in a museum in Shoshone, California, which is just on, it's sort of called the gateway to Death Valley, and I think the first line in that story is, this happens every summer, and in fact, almost every summer, it seemed, when I was a kid, eventually that time of the year would roll around where you would hear, a tourist went out into the desert without enough water and died, and I would hear stories of people, people would ask my parents if they could help out and be in the search party to look for these people, and if they would come to my mom's shop and get maps, and it was one of the real, part of the local folklore, really, is that this was a very real possibility, and I wanted to kind of present that, sort of the real, the sparsity and the severity of the landscape, and then this brothel, which is kind of a little oasis, right? And it's very, fecund, and there's a lot of supposed, fertility and eroticism going on, although that's, of course, kind of debatable.
But. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of desire, and a lot of it isn't being satisfied. You have Manny, and he epitomizes that, doesn't he?
Right, yeah. Manny is a gay man who's become the madam at the brothel, and he is really kind of isolated himself, I think, for a long, long time out there, sort of overseeing the women, the prostitutes who work there, and also these peacocks. He tends to a flock of peacocks that are, the owner of the brothel loves peacocks, which is kind of, obviously, perhaps it's a nod to Flannery O'Connor for me.
Well, thanks for saying that, because I certainly wouldn't say, oh, well, that sounds like so-and-so.
Well, she famously loved peacocks.
Uh-huh.
Also.
Another one of my favorites is Man of War, and I get a feeling that Milo is a composite of a lot of people you've known.
Oh, you're thinking of Harris or Milo the dog?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Harris.
Yeah, Harris.
Okay, Milo. A lot of dogs that you've known.
Milo is a composite of a lot of dogs I've known. Yes.
Okay, right.
True.
Thanks for correcting me.
No worries.
Yeah, this ornery old recluse, the rock hound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Harris is probably, I think that's a really smart way to characterize him. He's sort of a composite, which he would probably like that word, of course, because that's a rock word, He's a metamorphic rock, I think, if he's any, yeah. But he is kind of like this personification of the rugged individual,
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kind of wanted to ask myself, well, when I was growing up, a lot of men in my life, maybe a generation or half a generation older than me, you could tell that because they'd come up in the West, that they were really influenced by this kind of like John Wayne masculinity, which, arguably many people not in the West are. But I kind of wanted to ask myself what that would look like at near the end of a person's life. And what it would cost him. So in the story, Harris, he goes out, he has this ritual, he scavenges for fireworks on the 5th of July. He goes out to the Black Rock Desert and scavenges for fireworks. And one day, he finds a girl who's been left for dead out there. And I think she kind of forces him to, she forces the lie of the rugged individual, you know, that he's been, she forces him to confront a lot of stuff that he hasn't wanted to about being so isolated way, way out there. He lives in a shack, which is, you know, called the middle, you know, some people would say that he lives in the middle of nowhere, but of course, I would say it's not nowhere, it's just not green and lush and there are no rivers. It's not nowhere, but...
And he finds this mysterious young woman, Magda, and he may live out in the middle of nowhere, but by the end of the story, we realize you never live far enough away.
Yeah, right. That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah, he's certainly kind of... well, I don't know how to put it without giving stuff away.
Fine. You know? That's
but
fine.
I love that you said that, that you can never be far enough away.
Yeah. I'm trying to be subtle without spoiling. And I think it must be the longest story in the book, but it's also one of my favorites. And this one is set during the gold rush, and it kind of starts in Ohio.
That's right. Yes. It's called The Diggings.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that was the last story I wrote for the book. And... one of my teachers at Ohio State had read Battleborn with my thesis there, and he'd read the manuscript without the diggings before I'd written it, and he said, you know, this is pretty good, but why are the men always getting hosed? And he said, well, the way he started this conversation was, what's your deal with men, Claire? And I said, you will have to be more specific about that. So I think he was trying to get me to write a really, you know, virile young man, right?
Uh-huh.
And so I thought, you know, who more virile than a 49er? And I was finishing up my time at Ohio State, and I was getting ready to leave Ohio. So I think I wanted to write kind of a leaving Ohio story. So these brothers, they come from Cincinnati, and they set out west to the gold fields in California. It's 1849. And one of the brothers is afflicted in a way that he's convinced that he can kind of see the future. And so, and it's kind of a story about faith. He eventually becomes a minister, but it takes him a very long road to get there. And also about brotherhood, that the way that siblings kind of love and exploit each other at the exact same time. I've always, as an older sibling, I've come to realize how often we do that. Probably my younger sisters have known it for a very long time, but it's just now occurring to me.
Well, we get a strong sense in several of these stories of the sisterly bond. There's several that involve sister-sister relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing about The Diggings, as I was reading it, I had to keep reminding myself that the brother who is essentially telling the story was a man.
Yeah.
I kept getting the sense that this was a woman. Now, this was my error in reading it, but every time I would get a few pages further, I'd say, now, wait a minute. Now, this is a guy talking. This is a guy observing his brother going crazy. Does that make any sense to you, that I would feel that way?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it is a little disappointing to hear, I have to admit. But
I'm not trying to disappoint you. I'm just saying that was my sense. There was something,
sure.
Maybe it was just something feminine about this particular brother.
Yeah, well, he definitely is the beta in their relationship. His name is Joshua, and he and his brother Errol. Errol is always beating up on him, but also kind of manipulating him. He basically, you know, cajoles him into leaving his whole life and going out west, and then, you know, proceeds to kind of use him, you know, as he descends into this sort of insanity called lump fever, which was an actual like diagnosis you could get in 1849, was having lump fever, which is the belief that you're just about to strike gold. You're always just around the corner from it. So, I think that maybe that might be what you're picking up on.
Maybe that was it. And as he observes the literal descent into madness, we're saying as readers, wow, where's this going? And then we have these Chinese miners who are right there, and you really fall in love with them. They're wonderful characters.
Thank you. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read a lot about, I read a couple books about the 49ers, and Chinese immigrants were referenced a lot about how, and one thing that came up over and over in my research was that there was pretty much no one at the diggings, at the gold fields in California during the gold rush for whom conditions were worse than the Chinese. Mm-hmm. That even there were slaves there. There were Indians who'd been taken as slaves. There were people from all over the world. It was a like strikingly cosmopolitan scene up there in Placer, what's now Placer County, and so on. But the Chinese always really interested me. Did they, you know, were often the victims of severe violence. They could be murdered for the smallest, you know, supposed offense. And they're called Chinamen in the story, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But they are always aware that, kind of death is just around the corner for them.
Claire Vay Watkins joins us. Her collection of stories, Battle Born, was just published. Whenever I finish a book, I almost always come away with a favorite peripheral character. And I had one in your book. And I love this character. She's a baby named Miracle.
The Miracle, that's right.
What a wonderful baby. Have you known a baby like that?
I have, in fact. My niece, her name is Delilah. She's a lot like the Miracle. I think one of the things that is fun about the Miracle is that she doesn't really act like a baby. You know,
right?
In fact, so many babies don't really act like you know, the Gerber baby or, you know, TV babies or cutesy babies. So many of them are really very intense. And Delilah was very skeptical as a baby. If you ever tried to like baby talk to her or, you know, give her a toy, she hated toys. I mean, it's a little bit exaggerated in the story. Of course, she would play with some toys, but she preferred to have, you know, like somebody's keys or someone's sunglasses. You know,
a special toy.
Exactly, right. You know, she was sort of like she was saying, you know, don't condescend to me. I want what you're playing with, your cell phone there. You know?
Right.
Yeah, I love that. And the narrator in The Archivist, that story, The Archivist, is she's like kind of the baby, right? I mean, mm-hmm. She's so vulnerable, so needy. She's just like grasping at any kind of connection, any like authority figure she can, and she's always looking for the baby to make her feel better, and then the baby's like sort of doing her own thing, which Delilah was very, very much like.
Donald Ray Pollock wrote one of the many very positive blurbs for your book, and when we get to the end, we see that he's also someone that you know personally. I know sometimes blurbs are written by people that you don't even know, and when I talked to him recently on this program, I mentioned to him that I'd seen him doing some blurbing, and he says, yeah, he says, I really like to do that for first books by people that I really think deserve attention. So I read your book, and I saw his blurb, and just sounds exactly like that. And then I wondered what the process was for you, because I understand that you must have a great agent or something, because there were a lot of publishers that wanted to publish this book.
Well,
how did this work?
Yeah, I do. I mean, the really short version is I do just have a stellar agent. and I didn't even realize how much one of my friends would say that I am out punting my coverage. That's sort of an Ohio State kind of metaphor, right? But yeah, definitely. I didn't realize how much yardage I was truly out punting my coverage. But, yeah, Nicola Raggi is my agent, and she really is just such a, she's just like a a reader, you know, like she's a really, really passionate reader. And when she gets excited about something, I think people listen. And the editor of Granta, John Freeman, he passed some of my stories and my work along to her years and years ago now when I was still at Ohio State. And she liked them, and she didn't bat an eye when I said, well, you know, I'm working on a short story collection, not, say, a Manson family memoir. You know, she was sort of, she totally was picking up what I was putting down. You know, it was, was always, she's never, I mean, you hear a lot of kind of gross stories about agents telling their authors what to write or not being interested unless you have a novel or something. And Nicole was just like the exact opposite of all of that lousy stuff that goes on. And, you know, that she's never, she always just says, you know, write what you want. She gives me really honest, frank feedback. And she just, I think people kind of respond to her because she has just a real passion for reading.
That's wonderful. Well, I'm looking at the clock here. I see we have just a minute or two left, and it just seems like it flashed by. My guest is Claire Vey Watkins. Her collection of stories is Battle Born, and I don't want to end this conversation without asking you about the Mojave School.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Mojave School is a nonprofit creative writing workshop for high schoolers in rural Nevada. My partner, Derek Palacio, who's also a writer, he and I are starting it in my hometown in Pahrump, Nevada, and we're hoping for next summer to be the first session. It's going to be kind of just a place where, you know, reading and books and the people who love them are celebrated. And it's kind of, the idea is to kind of try to bring the artistic resources of big cities to really remote places. And so we're starting with the place I know the best, which is this little town out in the Mojave Desert. So
it's called Pahrump?
Pahrump, that's right. It's sort of a bastardized Paiute word that means like water from the rock, or so they tell me. I don't know if that's true. But, yeah, Pahrump, Nevada, and that's where the Mojave School will be.
Well, Claire, it's really been fun talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much for calling, Vic.
Our guest has been Claire Vey Watkins. Her new collection of stories is Battle Born. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week when my guest will be Garrett Kaiser. He's written a book called Privacy. And this is quite a book. Do you ever feel like you don't have much privacy and that we're losing our privacy more every day? Well, then you'll want to listen to my conversation with Garrett Kaiser, because he hits the nail repeatedly on the head. The book is Privacy. You can hear about it in the Book Nook. Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.